KBTC, a viewer-supported community service of Bates Technical College.
From KBTC Public Television Studios in Tacoma, Washington, it's the Northwest Now podcast. Each week, we take a closer look at the people and issues that affect all of us here in Western Washington. So sit back, relax, and join the conversation with your host, Tom Lason.
State and local governments are bound by the Public Records and Open Public Meetings Acts, but do they comply? The answer all too frequently is no, and millions of dollars in fines and penalties have been paid by taxpayers on behalf of the very taxing authorities that are supposed to be serving them. But the state now has Morgan Damereau serving as the AG's Chief Transparency Counsel. Will he usher in a new era of transparency or side with government against transparency? That's part of the discussion tonight with Chief Transparency Counsel Morgan Damereau. I tell you every year, and in the interest of transparency again tonight, I am a member of the Washington Coalition for Open Government. So this year, every Friday night in March, we're doing programs in conjunction with the annual celebration of open government known as Sunshine Week. We're turning it, however, into Sunshine Month. And speaking of Sunshine Week, next Friday morning on March 13th is WashCOG's annual Sunshine Breakfast at Embassy Suites in Bellevue. It's informative and a great way to get involved in protecting your right to know. Tickets are still available at washcog.org. I'd love to see you there. Washington State was one of the nation's front runners when it comes to open government. You might know the background, but here's a refresher. In 1972, Washingtonians overwhelmingly passed Initiative 276, the Public Disclosure Act. RCW 4256-30 reads in part, "The people in delegating authority do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know." And the rest of the language is equally uncompromising. But enforcing the act has been a nightmare. The public records ombuds in the AG's office was supposed to facilitate transparency, but that position came and went over the years. Now, though, there's a new public records and open government unit in the AG's office. And as of December 2025, Morgan Damereau runs that shop, holding the title of Chief Transparency Counsel. Morgan, thanks so much for coming to Northwest Now to start us off with our Sunshine Month here on Northwest Now, talking about the importance of government transparency and open records. I'm going to let you know that I am Aleut. I know you're from Linfield, and so I will try to keep this civil. We had a lot of big-time football games back in the day when you and I were in those schools. Talk a little bit, though. That's a nice segue into where did you go to school? How'd you come up? Where'd you grow up? Talk a little bit about your background.
Well, you know, I grew up here in Northwest. North Seattle is where, you know, I call home originally. Went to, you know, Ingemar High School up in Bothell, and then went down to Oregon, where I went to Linfield and became a Wildcat. So we'll just have to agree to disagree on that one. And then after on my undergrad, moved back in state. I was doing some environmental work, and then after about 5 years, decided to go to law school over in Montana, at the University of Montana in Missoula, which, you know, it was one of those really tough decisions in terms of, you know, ending what I was doing, but going to law school in Montana in Missoula is just a beautiful city.
Yeah. Did you get into hunting and fishing a little bit?
I did some hunting when I was over there. Always been fishing. Grew up working in a sporting goods store.
Nice.
Fishing all over the place. And so that was part of the analysis. If I'm going to go to law school, where do I want to live for 3 years? And you can't ask for a more beautiful spot than Missoula, Montana.
Yeah, you're not kidding. No. In the AG's office, you had previously been involved with public records and open government before you became the Transparency Counsel. Talk a little bit about the years you've spent and what those years looked like leading up, I would say, to this position.
No, happy to. I won't go back to the beginning of time, but you know, was with the AG's office, been there for 20 some odd years now, spent the first 15 of it doing labor and personnel work, which ends up, you have employees, you get public records requests, mm-hmm. ended up representing the state in a number of the cases that went to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, having to do with employee identity, employee request for information. And then in 2017, when the legislature passed the amendment to the PRA that said to the AG's office, stand up the public records consultation program, jumped at the opportunity to kind of do something a little bit different, a little more proactive. And so for the past basically 8 years, I've been working with local governments all over the state, everything from Medellin Falls down to Ilwaco, and corner to corner in the state, dealing with new public records officers, helping train them on what to do with public records requests, approaches to public records. And it was a great opportunity to, like I said, do something a little more proactive and do something that really, I think, had a positive outcome. Because what we found from doing it was, first couple of years talking with new public records officers, discovered that a lot of times people end up in this role and then don't know what to do, and that's when mistakes happen. And so really started really proactively doing what we called PRA boot camps, training new public records officers on approaches to public records, how to engage with folks, what they're supposed to be doing, those kinds of things.
Is there a structural conflict, though? Here's the AG's office. You, at the end of the day, represent cities and counties. I mean, you can't do the cities and counties, but you represent the state. But is the goal, are the goals aligned between the government and requesters? And how do you view that kind of that fox guarding the hen house criticism of training happening by the very entity that's supposed to be complying and frequently does it?
Well, I don't know about the frequently doesn't piece. I mean, I was looking at the JLARC report in terms of the number of requests, and what it was showing me was there's a lot of requests that are processed by the 200 biggest agencies that go off, will go off really well. In terms of my approach when I was kind of leading our consultation program, and I heard the comments, there's a conflict of interest. You can't be unfair and can't be impartial when it comes to this. And I disagree with that. I made a point of the last 8 years, really talking with people about there is no secret playbook when it comes to the PRA.
So not here's how to defend against it. Here's how to fit into it and do it correctly.
Very much so. Here's what the PRA says. Here's what the case law has instructed. It has gone well with requests when courts rule in agencies' favor. When when agencies have made mistakes, okay, where did that mistake come from? Okay, and tell people let's learn from the mistakes of others so we don't recreate that problem. And so it's really a proactive, the best lawsuit's the one that never happens.
Yeah.
And I fully believe in the PRA. I think there's a huge need for transparency. And so that was, something that speaks to me. There's a reason I've done this for 8 years. When I tell people, people ask me, what do you do? I work for the Attorney General's office. Okay, what do you do? And I described that, when I was doing the consultation and I was Chief Transparency Counsel, that I talk public records all the time. And then people look at me like, why? Why would you do that? And it's really because I think there is a value. People should know what's going on, the ability to see the communications. Mm-hmm. And so going back to your premise question, I'm not sure that there's an inherent conflict. As the AG's office, we give advice to our client agencies. And they get to make their own decisions. Not surprising. Anytime when you talk with an attorney, they give you options.
Yeah.
They don't always take our advice, and sometimes, it doesn't play out necessarily the best.
And I ultimately fall into the position, too. Would I rather the AG's office have a chief transparency officer or not? Even if there is, some might make that argument. Well, there's a built-in conflict there. They're advocating for the man, for the system. I'd still rather have somebody in your role.
And, I don't necessarily say I'm advocating for the system. I look at I always come back to the PRA. I always come back to read the law. What does the law require? This morning I was reading, before I came up here, I was reading the model rules proposals and trying to keep that moving forward and looking at some of the concerns that were shared. So I'm always looking at what's the baseline? What's in the PRA? What does it say we're supposed to be doing, keeping with that as kind of the guiding principle?
Talk a little bit about the model rules. What are they? How do they fit into the PRA and local governments? Has any gold emerged from some of the hearings that you've had trying to update them? Because they're very old.
Yeah, they needed some updating. And so obviously we received a request, a petition from the media to take a look at that. And they gave us their proposals for that. And you may be aware we had a hearing in November on the proposed model rules that the AG's office published. Their rule is, the model rules are really a guidance document. They're commonly cited by the courts as to, you know, the way that public records requests should be responded to, but they don't have the full weight of law. But they are that guiding principle in our best interpretation of, you know, what should agencies be doing as they're responding to requests. One of the things I, even before I started doing my prior job, I loved about the model rules is not only are they a guidebook and kind of a playbook for agencies and for requesters, they also tell you where it came from. It's not just, you know, somebody sitting in a room someplace with a keyboard. It goes back and cites to the PRA itself. It looks to the case law that gave us that
case law,
which is so crucial because people, there's lots of things we do that aren't necessarily written specifically into the PRA searching for one. It's, you know, our searching parameters came because court interpretation. So helping people understand, because sometimes when you read the law itself, you're like, well, I don't see this. Why are we doing it this way?
Here's the big one, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, as you well know, legislative privilege. What is your take on legislative privilege? Have you thought about or would you ever consider doing an amicus brief for that? And if legislative privilege is upheld, it really seems like Transparency Council almost becomes kind of this Orwellian thing that would happen where we have privileges upheld and we've got the Transparency Council working alongside the legislature. What's your take on that? Help me unscramble that a little.
Well, I'm not sure I can, you know, obviously we're talking about the legislature and the decisions they've made. I know you're aware from talking with folks in the past that when that issue has come forward, our office declined representation on that, and they hired outside counsel to take that issue forward.
Summit, right?
I don't recall who was
but
hired
it was outside counsel. That's an important point to mention. The AG's office didn't step in.
Yeah, we didn't step in, and I believe if I was watching something a couple of days ago, and I thought former AG, now Governor Ferguson, made a comment about actually filing an amicus in that case against some of that. And so, you know, it's one of those, I understand the arguments, but it's one that, you know, our office has kind of said, we're not representing on this issue.
Yeah. So. And it does, again, put you in a particularly difficult position, seeing the big picture, which I am sympathetic to.
it does at the same time, you know, that's the legislature and their records. But you know, if there's legislative privilege, it applies to that group of records. And their work. It doesn't change the PRA's application to every other state agency, all the local governments. You know, in my role right now, I'm doing a lot of work internally looking at the way we do business as the AG's office. We are subject to the PRA, so whatever happens in that case is the same as executive privilege. Mm-hmm. That applies to the governor's office. Legislative is the legislative branch. It's not going to impact us in the same way.
Yeah. You, in some of your communications as you came into this office, have talked about several things that your priorities, and I was wondering if you could just touch on them a little bit. You've talked about digitization. You've talked about ease of access. You've talked about retention and improving that in correspondence. There's some upgrades and some modernization you want to do. Do you have time for that, first of all? Is there a budget for that? And what are your goals?
That's, you know, the budget is always the 800-pound gorilla. I mean, in a perfect world, there'd be enough money to do everything. And this is not a new conversation, unfortunately, in a conversation I've had within the last few weeks, looking about our record systems, looking about what's there, how do we store things? When we stand up new systems, are we thinking about this piece of the puzzle? I've seen it play out with local governments. I've seen it play out in state agencies where, you know, public records officers are not part of the conversation. And they really need to be part of the conversations about, great, we can do this, and there's all kinds of amazing technology and a great way we can communicate with folks, and that's wonderful.
But getting it right on the back end is the problem.
Exactly.
Organizing, collating, getting it where you can just push a button, and maybe AI helps you in some way. You can push a button and fulfill a request, and guess what? The people who want to sue you, they go away because, boom, it's fulfilled.
Yeah, I think
crazy as that sounds.
we are approaching what I'm hoping is a watershed moment when it comes to this. I don't think we're there yet with AI, just in terms of the technology and being able to say, is it going to be able to identify all the sensitive information in a document? We are super close. We're seeing some really good work and advancements with being able to locate those documents. I've talked with a couple of local governments that are looking at an AI tool that would have the ability to basically crawl into all of their systems rather than have to, not surprisingly, you know, agencies have multiple systems they operate, and so you have to search A, and then you have to search the B, and then you have to, and so some tools are coming to be able to do, okay, this will be able to cross-pollinate and pull records out of all those. I haven't seen the outcome yet. I'm super excited about what that can mean for us. But that's also going to mean, back to the 800-pound gorilla, the money to invest in it. You know, anytime you buy new technology, it's that, with any business, that first person to buy is going to pay a premium. What can we afford? Is there the budget? And trying to find that sweet spot as to when's the right time to invest in this, and what can we do in the meantime?
Yeah, and it's kind of a little bit of a Jetsons discussion to some degree. I mean, just this past week, one of the major large language models came out with news that they can parse and reverse engineer an ancient programming language called COBOL, which was one of the moats that IBM had around it, crashed IBM stock, but the capabilities of it are amazing. And like you suggest, if software or AI can ever parse some of these old systems and link and somehow organize these records, a lot of the problems that I think have requesters a little tied up right now in terms of the time fulfillment takes and incomplete fulfillments. And, what about these records over here? These actually relate to these records, but we never knew that or couldn't find them. It could be revolutionary.
No, very much so. I'm looking forward to, once upon a time, I'd say the next 10 years. I think the next 5 is far more realistic, if not shorter. I mean, we're seeing such huge advances in it. And I was talking with one of our folks the other day about, one of the software tools we use, what they said it was capable of 3 years ago, and they're saying that, it won't be able to do this next step for 5 years. It's doing it now. It's just such an incremental or such a algorithmic kind of knowledge that's being built, the technology tools.
So I paint this picture of, like I said, this sort of Jetson scenario. We can push this button and do a perfect fulfillment. Between now and then, though, we have this problem with the time of fulfillments, and, there's so many stories about this, but the Seattle Times recently talked about a situation where they were waiting for 29 months for fulfillment from SPD, which is a little notorious in this area. And just waiting requesters out, they say, seems to be a strategy, as the Times puts it, quote, giving scandal-plagued leaders the cover of time. How can, between now and AI, in this dream scenario that you and I, over, what should be a couple of beers, have discussed, what can be done to resolve those kinds of problems between now and then?
Well, I've wrestled with that one. And sometimes it's a question of what the request is. In talking with public records officers, which has been my primary audience for the last 8 years, most public records officers are really, really a pragmatic group. They're like, okay, what's the request? What can I produce? And they're very much a customer, and this is the model I've been advocating for years, a customer service kind of model. What can what can we produce to the requesters? And it's obviously lots of factors come into it. One of them is, and I was looking at the volume of requests is up, not surprising. The volume of records we create as agencies is up. And so and we're also seeing a change in requests from 10 years ago. It used to be, I'd like a copy of this. Now we want any and all records related to.
In these dates. Yeah.
And one of the things I talk about I can't remember the exact number, but I was talking with our public records officer yesterday about a request and about the number of records that were involved in it. It was an astronomical number of records, because somebody wanted records over a 13-year period or something.
And a lot of the agencies are saying, hey, we've got these vexatious requesters. It's too much. It's too hard. Which I sympathize with, is it being used as a crutch not to fulfill?
There's been a lot of conversations about vexatious requesters, and I won't say that they're not out there. Every once in a while I hear that anecdotal story about somebody and, and you hear the backstory. By and large, it's not been my experience. Most requesters are, this is actually something I was looking at this morning, who is the average, the typical requester, whether it's the AG's office or statewide, it's individuals trying to get records. There are a few out there. I think that is true, but I don't think it is as huge, as large of a problem as people are perceiving at times. There are people who are hugely passionate about issues. totally different. And you know, making multiple requests doesn't make you vexatious. It makes you tenacious on an issue. And I'm okay with that.
I know some vexatious requesters who'll be happy to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is always the potential, and I've heard a couple, kind of horror stories about them.
Yeah.
But they're not, by and large, it's not a huge number.
Yeah.
I know there was some work last legislative session, and I don't think the bill passed, about, how do you identify this? And I think it's hugely problematic because in that range.
I want to talk to you about exemptions to the PRA. That list now numbers either crossed or close to 700 exceptions to the Public Records Act. There's two ways to look at it, though, and I want to get your view on the back-end problem. The front-end problem is you look at this giant pile of exemptions and say, oh my gosh, look at all the things that I can't ask for that are exempted. Fine, that's not a good thing. The other half of that is, I'm a public records officer somewhere in some jurisdiction. I'm supposed to go through a checklist of 700 things to make sure that this isn't somehow exempted. It almost seems like that makes fulfillment impossible. How do we reduce the number of exemptions and get the interests aligned, or am I just in a pipe dream?
Well, I've seen the same. I had not realized we're approaching 700. I knew we were 600 in terms of exemptions. That's an increase, obviously, from 1972 when the PRA passed. But I also always look at the other side as well. The data streams we had in 1972 were everybody had typewriters and file clerks, and everything was paper. Versus what we can gather now is incredible. And that's a good thing and whatnot. But we also end up with records and information that is highly sensitive for various reasons. So the legislature has to kind of balance these issues. In terms of the number of exemptions out there, you asked a question about how do public records officers address this. Fortunately for public records officers, they tend to be, they know what kind of records they have. Obviously the major producer of public records in the state is law enforcement.
So they can draw a box around their area a little bit.
Yeah, they know what they've got. Law enforcement, police reports have the same general information in them. But there's always that one-off, and that's where it takes some research. That's why they have, hopefully, legal counsel. That was part of what I did with my old role was, be that resource. Hey, I've got this record is concerning to me. Is there an exemption for this information? Because this seems sensitive. And sometimes, these are the ones you should consider talking about. Exemptions are discretionary for the most part. Some are mandatory. Having that conversation with folks. There is some inherent tension between exemptions and transparency, and how do you achieve that balance? Trying to protect people information that really should be protected, but also making sure people can see why government's doing what it's doing.
Another big one I want to get to is the auto deletions on Microsoft Teams. That has been controversial for years. The governor's office was going to come out with a report on this, and I think you were probably part of that too. What is the status of that report? It appears to have been delayed substantially. Are you guys still looking at this? Is it still a problem? Is there going to be a report? Bring me up to speed.
That's an easy one. I don't know. I took on the role of Chief Transparency Counsel literally 2 months ago.
Okay.
And haven't been involved in that report. Obviously, I'm aware of Governor Ferguson doing that and suspending the team's auto-delete. But I don't know the status of that because I have not been involved in it.
Okay. For folks, in our last minute and a half here, what can people do who want to get involved in this or who care about this issue? Is this just for media and requesters and governments, or is this an issue that can get down to the people who may be watching this program? How do they find out more? Does your office, are you open to public questions and comments about this? Talk a little bit about your public interface, if you would.
Happy to. People are always welcome to call me. I had a conversation with a member of the public last night for about an hour. Because the record requests have been received by a local jurisdiction involving their child's records as a juvenile. And so they had questions about why is this going on? What can I expect? I'm concerned about these issues. And so I going back to what I said a while ago, there is no secret playbook. There shouldn't be when it comes to this. I will tell a requester the same thing that I had talked with an agency about and say, this is what the exemption, this is how obviously we were talking about the RCW 1350 in this conversation. Here's how it's structured. Here's what you can expect. So I'm happy to talk with anybody. I know my contact information is on the AG's website. People can call me, as is an email address. Right now I'm a little short-staffed, and so I'm doing my best to get back to people. Obviously, Washington Coalition for Open Government, a great resource as well. And the Municipal Research and Services Center, MRSC, they work with a lot of local governments, but they have a lot of great information on their website as well in terms of how to educate, what to expect when it comes to the PRA, another great resource.
Good.
We've been also doing a lot of, trying to do more. We've done a few along the way where we've just done community conversations. I did one in Ocean Shores, one up in San Juan,
okay.
A few others where we just somebody sponsored us to basically set up a room for us, and we did here's the PRA 101 for requesters and for community members so they know what to expect.
Great way to end it, because I think being the chief transparency officer includes public outreach and coming to Northwest Now, and for that, we thank you so much, Morgan.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Everybody supports government transparency in principle. The bottom line, the real question is whether it's a principle you stick with when controversy strikes, reputations are on the line, money needs to be followed, or when waste or outright corruption need to be rooted out. And on that note, I wish Mr. Damerow the best of luck in his new role representing not the agencies, but rather the will of the people.